Going to start. Can you hear me? Everybody can hear me? Hi, I'm Anton Hirnov. I was an FFmpeg developer. I work with FFLabs, or maybe I used to. And past year, I implemented multi-view decoding in AV codec and in the FFmpeg CLI transcoder tool. In this talk, I will tell you what is multi-view, why might you care, why might you care even if you don't care about multi-view? And some technical interesting aspects, hopefully interesting, of this work. It was sponsored by Vimeo and Meta, so thanks for making this possible. It has wide implications beyond just multi-view, but multi-view in itself is also quite interesting. So to start, what is multi-view? I think the picture really says it all. You have two or maybe more video streams that are kind of independent, but not really. So they are independent in the sense that you treat them as two parallel video streams, but there's a lot of redundancy. So if you squint really, really closely, you probably can't see it from there, but they are actually not the same. They are actually different, and the canonical example of multi-view is stereoscopic 3D. So if this is the left eye view, the right eye view, that's the way people generally use this, but you can do other things with it. So now you want to code this thing. The naive way, you code two video streams. This is very simple and obvious, but your bitrate just doubled, so you don't want that. So what you do want is to make use of the redundancy and somehow predict the one of the images from the other and just encode the differences. You could use some kinds of hacks, like, well, maybe you put them side by side and use intra-frame prediction, but or you can interleave the frames and put them into one stream. That these are possible. People sometimes do them, I think, but it's quite hacky. And for instance, it forces you to always decode both of them, which you don't always want. Maybe sometimes you want just one of them. So multi-view is a set of tools to deal with that. So the thing I actually implemented is called MVHEVC, which is multi-view for the HEVC codec, also known as H.265. As you all know, H.265 is a successor to AVC or H.264, which we all know and love, the best codec ever. It's objectively true. In H.264, there used to be a thing which was called MVC, which was multi-view coding for H.264. I think it was used in 3D Blu-rays, and we had a long-standing feature request to implement that in AV codec, and that never happened for a bunch of reasons, which I will elaborate on later. It existed, it was used a little bit in the wild, but not really supported very much. So in HEVC, there is a similar thing, which we now call which people call MVHEVC, and it is it is a way of doing exactly what I showed you in the previous slide, of packing multiple semi-independent streams into a single HEVC bitstream such that the streams can predict from each other, but otherwise you can sort of treat them as independent, which is exactly what you want. It is based on multi-layer extensions. So I think in H.264, all of this was multi-view was a separate thing, scalability was a separate thing, other dancing animated ponies, it was a separate thing. In HEVC, I think that they unified it. There is sort of a general multi-layer extensions specification, and then it's specialized into multi-view, scalable encoding, alpha, I think some kind of depth texture thingy. I didn't look into it. But there's a bunch of things, of purposes it can be used for, but generally people care about multi-view, about alpha. I think some people care about scalable. Who knows? If you remember what a null unit header looks like, which you should, there is this field in it, which is always zero. And if it's non-zero, you scream and run away. And the point of this work is that you don't scream, you don't run away, you face it head on and do something useful with it. The full specification is insanely complex because all of these things, they can be used together. And you can sort of have a multi-view scalable stream with alpha which has up to 63 layers, which one of them is the base one. This is the layer ID 0, which can be decoded on its own by a decoder that doesn't know anything about any multi-layer. So it just ignores everything and just decodes the base layer. But the other layers sort of predict from it, and there can be a complex dependency graph. And as far as I know, nothing supports that. Even the reference implementation, like there's the base one, which only does base layer, and there's like three forks of it, one of which does multi-view, and the other one does scalable, and the other one does 3D. And I'm not sure which one of them does alpha. Maybe somebody knows. And they are separate, and none of them can do all of these at once. But in principle, per specification, you can do all of these together. And it's, if you look at the specification, which I heavily recommend, it's just completely insane. So we decided to not support, of course, any of that. We only support two layers, with the second one depending on the first. Although, with alpha being interesting for people, then maybe there will be a use case where you have a multi-view stream with alpha. Somebody should create it, but I don't think the demand for this is driven by VR, I think. So there probably has to be hardware that does this. So probably not, but it would be fun. But so far we can do two layers, and that's it. Why do you care? So one possibility, you care about stereoscopic 3D. You have VR glasses or Oculus Quest, Apple Vision Pro, one of these things, and you really like to record and watch videos on them. So that's one possibility. That's the canonical use case. You might care about alpha. So I didn't implement that, but I opened the door to that, and somebody else already wrote the patches. So that will be possible soonish, probably. But more generally, multi-view decoding, the reason why it was never implemented for H.264, or one of the reasons, and why it was hard to implement for this, is that it challenges a bunch of assumptions we make internally and also in the APIs about how video is decoded. For instance, you have a single input packet, like the coded HEVC data that you send to a decoder, and that decoder that contains all the views. So it decodes into multiple frames. Two in our cases, but we don't make the assumptions in the API. So in principle, n frames. So that was not really supported in a bunch of ways before. Now it is. And that has implications. So maybe it allows some things which were not possible before. And the other thing is that now you have a single decoder which produces frames for several independent streams or semi-independent streams. Which, again, it has implications. It might allow some use cases which were not possible before. So you might care even if you don't care about 3D. So what was hard about implementing it? First, inside the HEVC decoder itself. So AV codec has like generic code which is decoder independent, and then below that there is the decoder specific stuff. So this is for the decoder specific stuff. The main thing that you encounter, or the first one, is that a bunch of state that used to be per codec is now per layer. So you have your decoder context, which is a big struct with a bunch of state in it, and now a lot of that state is per layer. And so you need to have multiple of these contexts and per each layer you want to decode. A common approach, I don't know about your project, but in FFmpeg, a common approach that people very often do is that you add a bunch of children or a bunch of copies of the same struct inside it, which saves you, it seems like it saves you work. So it's because you don't have to really do anything, you just do that very simple thing, and from now on some things are per codec, and some are per layer. This is a horrible, evil obfuscation method, which you should never ever do. And if you do that, please stop. Because immediately when you do that, you lose the information. Which fields from the struct are meaningful in the parent and which are meaningful in the child? And now everybody who's reading the code later has to reverse engineer the struct, check all the places where where some field is used, and only then you discover which is which. And you might think, oh, but if I document it, surely this will fix it. Of course, nobody ever documents things, and if you do it, it will get out of date eventually because somebody updates the code and doesn't update the documentation. So documentation helps a little, not that much. And but also another problem is you have a bunch of dead fields. In the parent context and in the children, you have a bunch of fields that are just there, waste memory, waste cache, and don't do anything. So, and in the end, the amount of work it saves you, it's very little. It looks like a lot, but not really. And it's work that's very straightforward. You don't have to think about it. In the future, probably ChatGPT will do it. So please never ever do this. The thing you actually should do, you check all the fields, you find out which one are actually per layer, which you have to do anyway in the end. You just do, in this approach, you just do it more systematically. And then you add a per layer context. You move the things in that per layer context one by one, and hopefully you're done. So in my work, this was the majority of work by patch volume, but it was really straightforward, mostly. If your code is really crappy and entangled and spaghettified, this must be non-trivial, because moving one thing can depend on some other thing, which happened here to some extent, but not as much as it could have. For instance, the HT64 decoder has some more history, let's say, and doing the same thing there will be more complicated. If you feel like tackling that problem, be prepared for some pain. So that was the biggest thing I had to do. Another thing was frame output logic. As you all know, HEVC and also AVC, they have frame reordering. So when you decode a frame, you don't output it immediately. You put it in a decoded picture buffer, and then maybe depending on some conditions, you look at the decoded picture buffer, you select some specific frame from it, and then you maybe output it. One factor that complicates it is that there are things called sequences. A sequence is basically a segment of coded video which has the same parameters, like a single encoded video that was encoded at once, for instance. And this can change at runtime, so you can concatenate a bunch of videos and you get two sequences or multiple sequences. And whenever you switch the sequence, you have a bunch of frames buffered for output later, and so you could be decoding one frame but still be a frame from one sequence and still be outputting frames from a previous sequence, or in more pathological cases, you could be two sequences back or 16 sequences back, or probably not six, I think 15 is the limit if you really want pain. And we had a lot of complicated logic to handle that, and actually and what I had to do right now, because now we have, not only do we have to handle this, but we also have two views. And when you switch sequences, you can also switch the number of views. You can switch from single view to multi-view and back, or you can switch the positions of the views or their properties, blah, blah, blah. So this had to be added on top of that logic, which would be very complicated. And because I'm not smart enough to think about all that, I noticed that we actually don't have to do any of it, that all that complicated logic is only there because we have the constraint that a single input packet has to output at most one frame. But we don't have that constraint anymore. So I changed the logic to output multiple frames at once, which we can do, and all of that horror goes away. So this work actually simplified a lot of things, even though I Now it has to still interleave frames from multiple views. But now what it does is when it encounters a sequence switch, it just flushes the decoded picture buffer completely, which we can do, which is great. I can also notice frame threading is inefficient.